This is the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President, Tony Perkins.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld, and I'm sitting in for Tony, who's taking some time away from the microphone. As I am sure many of you know, a terror attack took place in Belgium's capital of Brussels earlier this week. The bombings took place at both Brussels International Airport and Melbeek Metro Station, leaving 30 dead and over 200 wounded. The investigation is early, but the working assumption is that authorities believe these men were part of the same network related to the Paris attack from November. Early that morning, ISIS was already claiming the attacks were carried out by their fighters. What message does this send to the United States? Are we vulnerable ourselves? Member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the representative from the 4th Congressional District of Kansas, Mike Pompeo, joined Tony with the latest.
Mike, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you today.
All right. It seems like these stories come with more frequency and the details more disturbing. Your initial analysis of the attack in Brussels today?
Well, it's obviously an enormous tragedy, and your point, I heard a little bit of your conversation earlier, this is becoming too common. And it's what happens, frankly, when we're afraid to go out and do what it takes to defeat an enemy that has clearly declared war on the West. And so all of the actions or inactions, as you care to describe them, of this administration with respect to allowing Al-Qaeda and ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism to expand and have safe havens, their reluctance to do the law enforcement work that needs to be done and the intelligence work that needs to be done ultimately creates increased risk of events just like today and the tragedy that we have now, dozens dead, hundreds injured, and still terrorists on the loose.
Now, Congressman, I'm sure you have seen or been briefed on the report by French investigators, the 55-page report, in the wake of November's attack there in Paris. And one of the things that suggests there's a lot of problems here, but one of the huge contributing factors to this is Europe and their move to have no borders and the way these terrorists are able to float freely from terrorist countries into Europe. I mean, that clearly, the immigration issue and the lack of protection of borders is clearly an issue.
It's plain on its face. Anyone with an ounce of common sense could figure as much. European borders, they've had free transit as between. They've allowed neighborhoods to become zones where law enforcement did not do the work that it needed to do. We can't permit that kind of thing to happen here in the United States. We have a task. And frankly, neither Republicans nor Democrats have taken this task on. Now it's an American issue. We've got to do the work that permits us to know who's coming in and out of our country, to control the flow of immigrants to this country, and make sure that we are doing the right thing. We know who's coming in such that the likelihood of an incident like this in the United States doesn't go away. You can't stop them all. But it just becomes greatly reduced because we have a handle on who's entering our nation.
All right. With that in mind, Congressman, three steps the next president needs to take to fill the void left by the lack of policy or bad policy from this president to keep this country, America, safe.
So I'd start with an intense and robust effort to destroy ISIS, and those aren't just words. There's actions that flow from them. It includes flying more than just a couple of sorties a day, understanding that while we want to keep collateral damage to a minimum, there are lots of things we could be doing to destroy the leadership, the communications elements, and their ability to continue to regenerate funds and soldiers. So a full-on destruction of ISIS, a comparable action not only in Syria where we think of ISIS being, but in all places that terror strikes with respect to a broader threat from radical Islam. It's not just ISIS, it's Al-Qaeda, it's Al-Nusra Front, it's Harar al-Sham. The group names change, but their desire to destroy the West does not. So we need to do that as well. And then the final thing, I guess I give two final things. The third item is we need to have a robust intelligence capacity. And that needs to be working with our allies, with their intelligence and ours. And we need to make sure that we give the tools to both law enforcement and our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines such that they can conduct intelligence operations to identify high-risk areas and begin to take these networks down in a way that reduces risk. And then finally, we need a leader who's prepared to talk about the real threat from radical Islamic terrorism. There's always an importance to speaking truth about these important issues, and we have a president who has declined to do that for his entire, now almost two full terms in office.
Let me ask you about that, because I know that that is often said. I've said it myself. I agree with it, that, you know, if you're not willing to identify the enemy, there's no way you can defeat the enemy. But it's not just a matter of semantics. It's not just a matter of, you know, being willing to say Islamic terrorist or the Muslim terrorist. I mean, if you fail to say that out of fear of offending, you are leaving yourself vulnerable and you're playing into the hands of the enemy.
That's exactly right. I've said this a number of times, and I've been mocked from time to time about what are the importance of the words. But, of course, it's with those words is a recognition of what it is you're up against. And you can, once you've identified the fact that they are at war with us, and it is not enough to just say, we don't want to be part of that war, we're going to go away. It's a recognition of the severity of the risk to the homeland and to Americans abroad, as we saw today. We have to begin by identifying the threat. And once you do that, all the full power of the United States of America can be brought to bear. Diplomacy, military action, intelligence operations, homeland security, all of the things that go into keeping Americans safe can come from a leader who declares to the folks who work for him in the executive branch that this is, in fact, a real threat, that we are at war with radical Islamic terrorists, and we're going to defeat them. That the utterance of those words drives enormous policy decisions within the bureaucracy, and it has been missing. And so we've been missing lots of the tactical activities that follow from it as well.
You may not agree with me, and feel free to disagree with me. That's fine. But you're a graduate of of West Point. You've served in the Army. I was in the Marine Corps. And one of the things that when you operate as a unit, when you operate as a body, you're held accountable for what others do. And that was one way you kind of police yourself by, you know, those who mess up are kept in line by the guys that do it right. And this political correctness of, well, we don't want to offend the Muslim community by saying that these are actually Muslim terrorists, would it not put the onus on them to clean up their community and hold these terrorists in check if we're willing to call this what it is?
Completely. I don't disagree one lick. We now know that in a place called Molenbeek, Belgium, and frankly other communities in Europe as well, that these folks have been hiding essentially in plain sight. And you know, in your neighborhood, you have a sense of what's going on. You may not know everything, but they're seeing it. They attend the same mosques. They go to the same schools. They're aware of these folks who have become radicalized. And they have an obligation to assist law enforcement, just as you and I do when we see someone who is moving towards committing a crime, and to help law enforcement identify that risk and to close it down. I'm not talking about creating a nation of narcs and people who spy and follow each other around. But simply making sure that they understand that within the Islamic faith there are folks who practice the Muslim faith who don't want to be extremists, and they need to help us identify those who do.
It sounds like a slogan. See something, say something. I think I've seen that somewhere before.
Yes, sir.
All right. Congressman Mike Pompeo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and have a good day.
If you'd like to find out more about this topic or Mike Pompeo, simply go to TonyPerkins.com. Coming up next, FRC legal expert Kathy Roos joins us to talk about your religious liberties on trial at the Supreme Court. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
Are you prepared to stand for real change? Mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 9th through 11th in Washington, D.C. Join thousands of like-minded Americans who envision a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers at the Values Voter Summit have included Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Governor Mike Huckabee, Laura Ingraham, Kirk Cameron, Dr. Ben Carson, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Ollie North, Mark Levin, and many others. In addition, there will be ample opportunity to network and meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview and to discuss important issues like religious liberty, the sanctity of life, natural marriage, national security, government overreach, and more. On September 9th through 11th, stand with us and fight for the renewal of this great nation. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information and to watch last year's event. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld, and while Tony is taking some time off this weekend, we're sharing a couple of the best interviews from Washington Watch Live from the past week. On Wednesday, oral arguments were heard in the Little Sisters of the Poor case before the Supreme Court regarding the HHS mandate in Obamacare, which forces religious organizations to provide drugs that can cause an abortion and would violate their religious conscience. And I do mean force. This is one of the biggest cases on religious freedom the court has seen in its history. Thankfully, members of the FRC team were inside the courtroom. FRC's Senior Fellow for Legal Studies, Kathy Roos, joins Tony with the latest.
Kathy, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be with you.
All right, Kathy, give us your impressions of the oral arguments there today before the eight justices.
Well, yeah, it was. It's apparently we're past the 30 days of mourning because Justice Scalia's chair was actually removed. In the last oral argument I attended, you know, his chair was there, draped with black bunting. It was very moving. So everybody's rearranged because they are set up in order of seniority, and the chief is in the middle, and then it goes left, right, as you're looking forward. So it was kind of shocking as we walked in because Sotomayor is usually on the far left. She was on the far right. And you kind of get used to looking at where people are for many, many years. So anyway, we really missed Scalia today as well, because judging from how the arguments went forward, we have the four more liberal justices are very clearly in favor of forcing the Little Sisters and everybody else with religious objections to violate their consciences and to provide things in their health care that go against their religion. I mean, it was really clear that the four liberals were perfectly fine with this mandate. And then Justice Thomas didn't speak at all, which is typical. And then Justice Alito, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Kennedy all seemed very critical of the government on this. And so, you know, it really looks like a 4-4 vote. And that would mean the Little Sisters would not win their case. They would actually lose their case because a tie means the lower court ruling stand, and most of those go against us and against people of faith. So it's really this would have been a victory dance, Tony, if Scalia had been with us. I mean, this would have really been a strong win, 5-4, but it would have been there because Kennedy was really with us, from what I can tell in the court today.
Wow. So if the Little Sisters of the Poor, and there were other cases that were kind of wrapped into this as well.
Yep.
If a 4-4 case basically remands it back to the decision at the circuit court, the appellate court, so that decision then stands. But that does mean that another challenge could then make its way up to the Supreme Court at a later time, does it not?
Exactly. So we live on to fight another day if it's a 4-4 tie. We lose in the short run, but because there have been most of the circuit court rulings have gone against us or in what we're arguing for on the side of truth and justice. So most of the circuits would have bad rulings that would control until, you know, another case would make it up to the Supreme Court. But again, that shows you exactly how important filling this Scalia seat with the right person is. If it's anybody other than someone that's going to see as Scalia would have seen, which is this is clearly a violation of religious liberty to be fined millions of dollars unless you violate your religious beliefs, then, you know, then really all is lost in terms of religious liberty. It will be an unrecognizable First Amendment. I mean, if the government is allowed, just as a bully would, to force you with the threat of millions of dollars of fines, you know, these groups are not wealthy groups that we're talking about. All of these are nonprofit religious institutions who are serving the poor, you know. They don't have a lot of money. So if they're faced with these fines, they're going to either have to close their doors. They're not going to, I believe they're going to stand firm. They're not going to violate their faith.
Right.
What they
Kathy,
believe.
We're almost,
so, yeah.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you about that religious liberty aspect. How central was that in the oral arguments and in the questions asked by the justices? Was there a sense in the courtroom today that religious liberty is what is on trial in America?
You know, it was like two worlds speaking to each other. The Obama administration's chief lawyer, the Solicitor General, showed that the administration is not really willing to budge at all. They want exactly what they want. They want to force these groups to provide this stuff in their health care plans, and they wouldn't really listen to any other suggestions. So I saw really a hostility toward religious liberty on the part of the administration. At one point, Chief Justice Roberts asked the Solicitor General, would you even mandate that churches themselves be subject to this requirement? And he said yes. He thinks the government can even do this to churches that are churches, not even nonprofit religious. So that was really stark. That was kind of the bombshell in today's argument, I think.
Wow. Wow. Kathy Roos, as always, thanks so much for joining us. Always enjoy your insight on the court. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you.
You can find out more about Kathy Roos when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'll be right back with more from Washington Watch right after this. Don't go away.
One of the questions I often receive from our listeners is, what can I do right here in my community to make a difference? The answer? A lot. And one of the most effective ways to make a difference right where you live is by organizing and leading a culture impact team in your church. A culture impact team, or CIT, will help keep the members of your church both informed and engaged through a wide variety of tools that we can place in your hands. Go to cultureimpact.org today for more information and order a Culture Impact Toolkit. We can provide you with all the training and materials you need to keep your church informed, inspired, and engaged. It's all free, and we can send it out to you today when you visit cultureimpact.org. Invite your friends at a church to join you in setting up a Culture Impact Team. We want to help you answer the question, what can I do to make a difference? So visit cultureimpact.org or call us today, toll free, 800-225-4008.
Spend a semester as an intern in Washington, D.C. with the Family Research Council. You will get a chance to experience the rich history and culture of our nation's capital and attend congressional hearings, events, rallies, and lectures all over D.C. Further, you will develop your skills in research and writing about the sanctity of life, marriage and family, and religious liberty. The internship program includes free housing just a block away from Capitol Hill and the Supreme Court, as well as a paid stipend. To learn more and apply, visit frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. This election cycle on the GOP side started out with 17 candidates and now has been whittled down to just three: Donald Trump, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Ohio Governor John Kasich. Many political pundits believe this is simply a two-man race between Trump and Cruz. And this week, 98 delegates were up for grabs. What does the delegate race look like moving forward? The founding member of Rasmussen Reports and current president of STIRC, Scott Rasmussen, joined Tony with the latest.
Scott, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's always great to be with you.
Well, first, your analysis on where the race stands right now.
Right now, we're in a situation where the traditional Republican establishment has been defeated. Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, these are the types of candidates they hope to see win the nomination. It's not going to happen. The choices are down. I agree with what you said a moment ago. It's a two-man race between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. And right now, Donald Trump has the advantage. He's up in the delegate count. He has won more states. But he's like a baseball team that's in first place at the All-Star break. You know, you'd rather be in first place than second, but there's a lot of games left to be played. And if Donald Trump wants to win the nomination, he has to continue winning. If Ted Cruz starts to win starting tomorrow and wins most of the remaining contests, he will end up as the GOP nominee.
And this is an unusual cycle. Rarely do we go this late into the process and the nomination is not sewn up.
Yeah, very, very unusual. In fact, my state, New Jersey, votes on June 7th, and I expect that we will still be very active in the process at that point. We haven't seen anything like this since 1976, when Ronald Reagan challenged incumbent President Gerald Ford. On the Democratic side, we had a similar situation in 1980 when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter. But this is really unprecedented, you know, in terms of the way the process has played out. And let's face it, we've never had somebody with no political or governmental experience like Donald Trump leading the field at this point.
Well, you used the reference of 1976, and that's an interesting one because Gerald Ford had ascended to the presidency without an election with the resignation of Richard Nixon. And there was a very serious conservative challenger, by the way, of Ronald Reagan, governor of California. And he, in that, where it was not settled up until the convention, they were able to even bribe, cajole, do whatever they needed to do to get the delegates. And Gerald Ford succeeded in getting the requisite number of delegates and winning at the convention, but lost the general election to Jimmy Carter.
You know, everything about that situation was very unusual because of the Watergate experience and the damage done to Gerald Ford's political prospects when he pardoned Richard Nixon. But there's something that I do think is very relevant to where we are today. The main battle, the main question in that convention came down to a fight over the rules. Ronald Reagan at that point had named a potential VP that he would run with. It was not well received. He tried to get a rule passed that would force Gerald Ford to name his running mate before the delegates voted. And Ford's campaign managed to hold the line, keep all their delegates in line. And once that happened, you knew the race was pretty well over. I expect, and this is something we've been missing in the conversations, we're going to have primaries. They're going to continue until June 7th. But the campaigning does not end at that point. There are going to be hundreds and hundreds of unpledged delegates. Some of them were elected that way. Some of them were elected to support people like Marco Rubio. And these delegates are open to persuasion, as you put it, cajoling and bribing and doing whatever it takes. Well, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are going to have lists of these hundreds of delegates who are not pledged to either of them, and they have a chance to get to the magic number of 1237 if they can convince these unpledged delegates to be on their team.
Scott, I want to go back to your point you made earlier. You wrote about this in one of your latest pieces, and that is the fact that the establishment has been defeated. What does that mean in the bigger picture of presidential politics in America?
You know, this is really an enormous game changer. Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, and then just about every Republican nominee since had opposed Ronald Reagan when he was running in 1980. It was a hijacking of that Reagan moment. And there's an awful lot of people in the Republican Party who have gotten very comfortable with the way of doing business in Washington. They don't argue so much against power going to Washington. They just say they would manage it better than the Democrats or have better policies than the Democrats. And the Republican voters and most voters around the country disagree with that idea. They think that the voters are quite capable as citizens at making their own decisions about their own life, working together in community to solve problems. It's a different viewpoint. And the fact that the Republican establishment has finally been defeated, regardless of who wins the nomination, regardless of who wins the general election, is going to open up the GOP in new ways to a new generation of leadership that I think will be much more responsive to concerns outside of Washington.
Yeah, I think I do think that's going to be the big story coming out of this election cycle, regardless of who prevails on the GOP side. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Scott Rasmussen is my guest. He is the president of STRC, founder of Rasmussen Reports. He knows his numbers, and that's what I want to ask you, Scott. What are we missing in the numbers? What is the story that is to be seen in the numbers?
Well, the biggest story is people get too hung up on particular numbers, and they think that you can predict the future in a rapidly changing environment with numbers that are a little bit old. In particular, what that means in this case, we have absolutely no idea what Marco Rubio's voters are actually going to do now that he's out of the race. Will they support Ted Cruz? Will they stay home? Will Kasich's voters, as they begin to see his as a campaign to nowhere, will they begin to drop out of the process? Or will they support Donald Trump or Ted Cruz? I can't really imagine many Kasich supporters going to Donald Trump, but perhaps they'll sit home. We won't know these things until people actually go to the polls in a two-man race. And so tomorrow we'll start to get some of the answers. And what we'll look at is, what was the shift? What is it like? What are voters doing differently now that we have this two-man race? And we also know that voters are very strategic in their voting. People, as the process goes on, if they really get to the point where they say, I either don't want Donald Trump or I don't want Ted Cruz, they will vote based on the dynamics of a particular race in their state, a particular situation in their state. And that means it's even conceivable that Ted Cruz could pull off some surprising victories in places like California that you wouldn't expect right now. But the world will look a lot different on June 7th.
And a big thank you to pollster and political commentator Scott Rasmussen. You can find out more about today's guest when you go to tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234.